Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Victor Hu for a conversation on growth stage investing in education technology, or edtech. We'll discuss his journey in education. We'll break down growth stage investing in edtech, and we'll discuss social impact. Victor is the co-founder and managing partner of Lumos Capital Group, which is an investment firm focused on growing companies in the human capital development and edtech sectors. Lumos is based in New York and invests globally. Their portfolio companies currently serve more than 5 million students. Prior to founding Lumos, Victor was the global head of investment banking for the education, technology, and knowledge services sectors at Goldman Sachs, which is quite a mouthful, Victor, where he completed more than $50 billion worth of transactions. He started his career in law, having studied a BA at Amherst, a JD at Harvard Law School, and an MBA at Wharton. I met Victor in 2022, and in the years since then, he's been extremely generous with his time, advice, and introductions as I've invested more and more in the education sector. Victor, it's really great to have you here today. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much, Monde. Thank you for having me.
All right. So as we start, before we get to growth stage investing and edtech, I'd love to start off learning about you. So please tell us a bit about your journey, where you grew up, a little bit about your family, and ultimately your path into education.
Absolutely. And again, thank you for having me. This is fun for me because South Africa actually has a very special place in my heart. I actually learned English in South Africa. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So I'm originally from Taipei, Taiwan. My father is a career diplomat and civil servant. Mom was an educator. And so as a result of my dad's job, we moved around every 2 or 3 years as a kid, as a family. And so the first place I moved to after Taiwan was South Africa. And then after that, every 2 or 3 years, we moved generally to a new country. And so I attended 10 different schools before I went to college. But ultimately, from high school in Asia, I ended up coming to the US where I am now for undergrad. I went to Amherst College, as you mentioned, one of the very few institutions that is need blind to international students. So both my older sister and I went there pretty much on a full ride and very, very grateful for that particular opportunity. And from there, I ended up practicing law. I first went to law school. And then in New York City, ended up practicing international M&A and securities law at a firm called Cleary Gottlieb. My interests were broadly taking me in the direction of business and finance. I went back to business school, did finance and entrepreneurial management. During that time, I had an opportunity to work at Zephyr, global emerging markets private equity firm founded by the great Tom Berry, who actually got his start investing in South Africa after Nelson Mandela came to power. So just a very small world in so many ways. And Tom remains a mentor and advisor to us to this day. And then post business school, I joined Goldman Sachs, first in New York. I ended up moving out to San Francisco and ended up staying there for close to a dozen years, where I initially started in technology investment banking. But quickly, my passion for the global education sector really started to intersect with my work. And I had the opportunity to co-found a group to focus on what we ultimately call the Education Technology and Knowledge Services Group, really covering education businesses of all kinds, both the traditional formats and models, the publishers, the schools, businesses, but also the new innovative, disruptive business models in software, internet, and the like. And so I did that over the course of about a decade. I had the opportunity to work with some of the most interesting and successful education businesses around the world in every part of the market. And then from there, along with a friend, my co-founder, James Tien, we started Lumos Capital Group to address what we believe to be a gap in the market for sector-focused growth stage private equity and growth investment. And so that was the start of Lumos Capital Group about 6 years ago.
That was a whirlwind tour. There's a lot of depth in there in so many phases. I'd love to double click on your upbringing. Going through 10 schools by the time you reach college is highly unusual. And some of the countries as well that you lived in, you mentioned South Africa was the first. So I'd love to just learn a bit more about that, about some of the other countries in addition to South Africa that you went to school in during your childhood.
Well, in the early part of my childhood, I actually moved back and forth between South Africa and the US. And so I kept switching accents. I was either the little Chinese kid with a South African accent here in the US, or I was the little chubby Asian kid from the US with an American accent in South Africa. Went back and forth for a number of years until my early teens. Then I went back to Asia. And then over the years, I've had opportunities to live in a variety of different countries. I've lived in Japan. My father, at one point, actually, after I went off to college, was posted in Germany as the representative there. And then he represented the Republic of China and Taiwan and Singapore. And so over the years, our whole family has been in all these different places. I've lived in Chicago and DC. When I was in South Africa, I lived in Pretoria first in the late 1970s. And then when I returned in the 1980s, I lived in the Johannesburg area, and obviously I traveled across Southern Africa. And recently, I actually had the opportunity to take my family back to Africa for their first visit to the continent. And we spent time mostly in Uganda while we were there.
That's wonderful. What an international journey. And languages that you've picked up over the journey, what languages can you speak now?
Well, I've had exposure to many languages. I can't say I speak any of them particularly well, but I remember there was a point in time in Johannesburg where I was learning Zulu, Afrikaans, Latin, and English, all mandatory in school. And then my father was having me tutored in Chinese at home. And so I was just swimming in languages at that point in time. I've also learned some German. I've learned some Japanese. Today, I try and speak Chinese at home with my kids. And obviously, I work in an English business setting. But every other language had its place. But generally speaking, it's not well established today in my brain. So language is so much a use it or lose it kind of thing. But I'm very grateful for the opportunities to have not only the linguistic exposure, but really the cultural exposure over time to see people of all countries and languages. And that's had a big impact on how I've thought about the world over time.
Okay. And we'll get to Lumos in more detail, but just on this topic of an international outlook that you've grown up with, has this translated as well into Lumos? Do you invest globally? Just a bit more on that side.
We do. So we've started by focusing primarily on the US market where we're based, just because it's a little easier to get to and easier for us to manage. But we have investments in Europe, in France, in Spain. We have investments in India. And we've looked at companies from around the world. And obviously, education is a universal need. One of the reasons why it's such an attractive sector is that it's a long-term secular universal need. Everyone in the world cares about it to some degree or another. And it's, every country's at a different stage of development. Every education system is unique in its own way. And it's just an extraordinarily, endlessly interesting market to follow.
Okay, that's great. And I really appreciate you telling us about your upbringing and how it's influenced you. And it really is unique for a global investor to have lived in so many different places and have had that path.
Well, I can tell you, Mondi, I think back to why I'm so interested in this sector, and really goes back to not only that background growing up across these different schools, but I think back to the important people in my life over the generations. I'll just point out two really quickly. So my two grandmothers, one of them actually did not have the chance to go to school at all. And she married young in her teenage years, ended up raising 9 kids mostly by herself, but through her sacrifice and through her investment, most of her kids had an opportunity to do advanced degrees overseas, including my mom. And so that ended up creating incredible opportunity downstream because of her sacrifice and her investment in education. My other grandmother had an opportunity earlier to pursue international education. She was one of the earliest Chinese women actually to get a PhD in the United States in the 1930s. Oh. And that enabled her ultimately down the road to become the first female president of the main teachers college in Taiwan. And so she was partially responsible for educating a whole generation of teachers in Taiwan in the 1960s and 70s. And so I think about education really as upstream of so much of human flourishing and opportunity. And that's such an important reason why I'm passionate about the space.
It's extraordinary. I'm so glad you went there. We almost left that and onto EdTech, and I would have missed such a rich story. So I really appreciate that. And it echoes so much with my life as well. And I'm sure many others who are listening to this, for me, as I think about your story, a similar path as my maternal grandmother and the sacrifices that she made and the education of her kids versus her education and her parents' education is just completely different. You know, huge advances in each generation that went. And similarly, my mother had the opportunity to study abroad as well, and it wouldn't be there without the sacrifice of her parents, and that's then I'm the beneficiary of a lot of that hard work and sacrifice that's happened above. I'm keen then to move on to some of the main topics for today, Victor, which I'm glad to discuss with you and break down, and that's growth stage investing in ed tech. Now, that's quite a jargony sentence, growth stage investing in ed tech. So I'm keen for us to go here, start right from the beginning. Just give us the lay of the land. What is ed tech? What are some of the verticals within it? How varied is the sector?
Sure, Andy. And we think of the markets really as all things related to education, workforce development, learning, and into talent. And so we've called it broadly human capital development. There are a number of ways to think about the market, but we first start by thinking about the end markets following the age spectrum of the individual from early childhood through K-12 as one very large end market. We think about higher education, alternative higher education, vocational education as another important end market. And then we think about the workforce development, enterprise learning and corporate learning into lifelong learning as a third important end market. And so if you follow the age spectrum, there are important education, knowledge and talent needs across all of those markets. And we invest in the technology companies, the services businesses that serve those end markets, and they provide a wide variety of services and products and platforms that enable the stakeholders in all of those end markets to do their jobs better, to learn a little bit more, to have access to higher quality education. Globally, it's about a $12 trillion market. So it's really one of the largest markets in the world. That's obviously across public and private sector spend. It's broadly growing at the rate of GDP, but the private sector piece is growing faster. But what's interesting also is that a fairly small percentage of that spend is digitized. It's somewhere around 5 or 6% today, but that's growing much, much faster than the rest of the market. And so that part of the market, the spend that is flowing into technology and digital oriented companies, what you've broadly characterized as ed tech, really the software, the digital content, the internet enabled models that serve the sector, that enable virtual services and products to move across borders and across geographies. That is really what we think of today traditionally as ed tech. But we actually invest beyond that, also into services, technology-enabled services, and other types of companies that serve the broader markets. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of the landscape of the market that we invest into.
Okay, so it's clearly very, very broad sector, lots of different verticals within it, and also very large. I mean, 12 trillion growing at, you know, broadly GDP, and 5 to 6% of that being digitized results in a very large market, which is funny because as you well know, some people don't consider education and investment market, as, you know, healthcare wasn't considered that way, call it, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And yet the numbers that you're saying here are very large. Maybe just while we're there on the industry and its size, et cetera, maybe if you could just name a few listed companies, because those are obviously people will know and identify with, just a few listed companies in this sector that you know of.
So a listed company on the content and material side, a more traditional type of business model might be Pearson, that is listed in the UK. Most people understand what Pearson does, providing materials and content traditionally as a publisher. But as they've diversified and evolved over time, increasingly digital services and working with schools in different ways to take their products and services online. A company that we just invested in that was listed, I actually had the opportunity to take public about 10 years ago. It's called Instructure. And so Instructure provides learning management systems, really software that is at the heart of teaching and learning. It's sold to universities and K-12 schools, as well as professional organizations with learning communities. And this was a listed company since 2015. Then it was taken private and relisted, and actually now taken private again. And we had an opportunity to invest alongside our partners with KKR in that particular deal. And that company has grown tenfold since they were taken public at the end of 2015. Other companies in the sector are schools-based businesses, such as companies here in Africa. They're interesting listed schools-based companies like Avitech and Nord Anglia Education, for example, was a listed schools-based company for a long period of time and then was actually taken private. There's been lots of transactional activity in the sector as companies go in public and then go in private again. Another business that was taken public and then taken private very recently in a almost $6 billion transaction is PowerSchool, and they provide the software that provides the student information services, the backbone and the records of students and within schools that help schools ultimately run their infrastructure. So lots of different examples here of content businesses, software businesses, as well as schools-based businesses. And that hopefully gives you a lay of the land.
That's excellent. And that just drills down the point. I mean, there's multiple billion-dollar plus listed businesses. You know, a couple of others that come to mind as you're talking: Coursera listed, billion-dollar plus market cap; Udemy listed, billion-dollar plus market cap. So, yeah, absolutely, a diverse sector, and with that is readily investable today.
Absolutely, one of the most interesting consumer-facing companies in the sector, Duolingo, started really just as a single application, right? To learn another language, an app on your phone that was provided largely for free in its early years. And as that business has evolved and has started to take on additional subject areas, it's grown exponentially. It's become a massive multi-billion dollar market. I think $14 or $15 billion in market cap last time.
They've got us all addicted, Victor. The green owl. They've got us all addicted. And then now they start charging, eh?
Yes, indeed.
No, that's lovely. And maybe just to carry on making it tangible, because it's such a broad sector, I'd love to, if you could just think of an investment or two that you've been involved with over the course of your career. What product or service did they provide? Who was the customer in this instance? Is it a parent? Is it the student? Is it a school district? Is, you know, who do you consider the actual customer? And from your lens, why were they attractive as an investment?
I'll give you a few different examples, again, to show you the breadth and the diversity of companies in this sector. So we invested in a company called BookNook that does virtual live tutoring that is sold into the K-12 school or district. So it's free to individuals and families. It's really a way to democratize tutoring, to enable students who are a little bit behind in reading or math to be able to catch up in a small group virtual setting with a well-trained educator. At the other end of the spectrum, a company that we invested in very recently, a business called Core Education, they partner with small college and universities to transform their business model. They are a long-term operating partner that helps companies, helps college and universities rather, to diversify their revenue stream, increase their enrollments, streamline their costs, and implement technology. So they're a very different type of company, but their mission ultimately is to enable these small colleges to continue to do what they're doing even better with a more sustainable business model that prepares students for the 21st century in ways that many colleges and universities sometimes have struggled to do as technology and as society and as the labor markets have evolved. And so this company comes alongside of these colleges to help them transform. And then one perhaps that I'll dive a little bit deeper into to give you a different flavor for the type of investments that we do is called Transfer VR. So what they actually provide is virtual reality software and simulations that helps with training and career exploration. It's a company that is sold into workforce development boards, into community colleges, into K-12 districts, and into nonprofits. And so a pretty diverse array of customer groups. And their software enables any adult learner or a high school student, you know, donning the headset to explore what it's like to be an electrician or to practice a particular skill on the automotive assembly line or in the ER as a physician's assistant. And it provides a completely different way of learning. It gives someone who might struggle in a traditional educational format, listening to a lecture, or perhaps not be able to focus on an online learning module, to learn by doing with the virtual reality headset on, with the controllers on their hands, and be able to actually have a more emotionally engaging and resonant learning experience. And so we invested in Transfer about 3 years ago and have really participated and been the beneficiary of their growth. They've grown from sub 200 customers at the time that we invested, and now they're over 1,000 customers as this particular technology has taken off.
That's really fascinating, Victor. I mean, the diversity of the companies that you've spoken about as well, just jotting them down here. One sells into a school district, you know, and is providing after-school tutoring. The other sells into community colleges. The other, it's to higher education institutions. So just the diversity of who you're selling to. And the second theme that stands out for me is this topic of experiential learning, which comes through in what you're talking about. I felt, so here in South Africa, children have to study two languages through school, and people go 12 years of schooling, generally studying, usually it's English and one other, which could be Afrikaans or could be Zulu or something of the sort. And you get to the end of your 12 years, let's say you've studied Zulu as your second language or Afrikaans as your second language. And most people wouldn't be able to have a conversation with, say, the cashier at the supermarket or the like in that second language, which they've spent 12 years on. I've always felt, my goodness, that time that we spend could be so much more useful. There's got to be a better way to teach that language and to learn that language. If you had spent the same amount of time, that 12 years, but doing it, let's say, via Duolingo, can almost guarantee there'd be far better levels of proficiency in actually being able to use that skill that you've learned rather than just being able to pass an exam. And Transfer VR is a great example of that, obviously a bit later stage. But it would be very hard to learn what being a surgeon assistant is like on a pen and paper. It's something that you have to experience. So those are very rich themes, and I enjoyed that. Just thinking about these a little bit from the investment, with your investment hat on, as this is the Education Investment Podcast, maybe talk to, you can pick any of them as an example and just why you felt that was an attractive investment.
Sure. So first and foremost, we want to make sure the product and service really is helping the stakeholder, really is helping the end user and the customer achieve their objectives, their learning objectives, or is creating a real benefit. And so we focus first and foremost there to ensure that this company is providing a very valuable product and service that is sticky, is providing value, and will have a recurring relationship with that customer over time because of those benefits. Certainly, we think about the financial profile of the company. Now, we invest at the growth stages. Really, that means a company that is past the venture stage. So they've proven product market fit. They've proven that a market exists for their product and that customers are buying and benefiting. And we provide expansion stage capital and growth capital really to help that company scale. And in some cases, we also will be investing in growth recapitalizations to help earlier seed stage or venture stage investors exit. And sometimes we'll invest in and acquire control in more of a private equity format. So we're flexible in the way that we deploy growth equity and growth capital into the sector. But those are some of the formats. The company typically has approached or is exceeding $10 million of annual recurring revenue. These companies don't have to be profitable day one, but usually we are thinking about their business model and their clear path to profitability, typically inside of 18 months. We want to make sure that there are strong unit economics, strong gross margins, for example, and real operating leverage so that the company can be a successful business model as it continues to scale and create sustainability over time. And clearly, we spend a lot of time thinking about the founding team and the management team. You know, we are really looking for missionaries, not mercenaries, people who are deeply personally invested in what they're building. They have empathy with the people that they're serving, and they're in it for a bigger purpose than just themselves. Because we find that companies in this sector, first and foremost, what's attractive about it is they do tend to attract more people of that type of nature and caliber. But secondly, it's those people that end up having the endurance and the passion to stick it out over the long term and build a company that lasts.
I love that. I've never heard that phrase. Missionaries, not mercenaries. That's really stuck in the mind. And I love that. The first point you mentioned there was helping the end user. And it makes me think a lot. If I go back to, you know, it's now close on 15 years ago, actually, if I would think of it as the MOOC sort of craze. And there was a lot of talk then on education, or education technology, at least displacing teachers or people go direct. And there was a lot of that talk. And there's been a distinct shift as I've seen it. And the people who I consider the smartest investors have spent a lot of time on tools that enable. It could be the teachers, it could be lecturers, it could be university administrators. I mean, there's so many people in the sector, the pupils themselves and a tutoring capacity, so many differing ways. But it's, as you said, helping the end user. It's providing value to that end user more often, I find, than it is, you know, displacing someone within the value chain. So I was really glad to hear that.
Absolutely. Now, the human elements within learning and in teaching, obviously, just cannot be underestimated, particularly in the early years. Students learn so much better in the context of a safe, warm relationship with their teachers. Now, over time, in the adult learning world, a percentage of learners can absolutely be self-directed and learn through technology. And technology provides extraordinary efficiencies and impact and access at scale for so many people. But we've never lost sight and we'll never lose sight of that important human element. The knowledge transfer that comes in the context of a great relationship is really how education starts. When you think about a child learning from their parents in the first early years, and then eventually from teachers over time, and that provides a really important context for all the learning that is happening. And today, an important part of what we do is we invest in the software and tools that enable teachers, as you say, to be able to do their jobs better, to perhaps spend a little bit less time late at night grading papers or finding a lesson plan that is perfect, because they are able to access a marketplace of lesson plans of that have been created before them, or because an AI technology is doing the first 80% of grading and they can then go and do some checking and add some personal encouragement and other things that enable that teacher perhaps to be a little less burnt out over time and be able to invest a little bit more time and energy in the relationship with the child. And so we think about that broader context of teaching and learning and really are trying to invest in the tools and the platforms that empower the people behind it.
You were answering there the question in relation to a specific company. I think we were using TransferVR as the example, and you know, your framework for what is attractive there, providing a value to the end user, the financial profile, as well as the team. Missionaries, not mercenaries, is actually a good, even generic framework for thinking about investing in growth stage ed tech. So just as we think about the generic and for Lumos, how you think about a generically attractive investment in ed tech, are there any other features which you'd want to add?
Certainly, we think about impact. We'll talk about impact, I think, a little bit later, and so we can go into that. But that's an important dimension of what we do. So we have a investment thesis centered around the business case for the company on the one hand, and then we have an investment thesis centered around the impact case on the other, and how is the business ultimately delivering higher quality outcomes, better access, et cetera. And so we'll go into that in a little bit more depth, but that's an important additional dimension to how we evaluate investments. Ultimately, we're thinking about, does this company deserve to exist? Should it be scaled? Should it grow to a place where it can become a category leader? And what is our place in helping to partner with this company to enable that to grow? You know, we recognize that we have a certain set of skills and backgrounds that are suitable for certain types of companies. And so we're looking for that perfect partnership where our background, our mindset, and what we're trying to do with Lumos Capital Group aligns well with what the company and the founders and the management team are trying to do with their mission. And so we really think about that partnership quite a bit, because ultimately it is very much a long-term deep partnership. In fact, we think about our model specifically as deep partnership, because an important part of what we bring to the table is our sector focus. And so we want to be able to add value through our network, through our experience in the industry over time. And so thinking about that fit is a really important part of our investment evaluation as well.
That's great. Let me follow you right there. So the fourth item you've added now is impact. And I must say, this is something that from the outside, when I've looked at Lumos, that I've really admired. You spend a lot of time thinking about impact, and your reporting on it is really good. I've obviously read your impact report, and you've got a great advisory council on it. So clearly, this is something you spend a lot of time and energy on. So the first question is just, why do you spend a lot of time and energy on this? And how have you managed to integrate it into your sort of end-to-end investment process?
With James, myself, Rowan, the rest of the founding team of Lumos Capital Group, when we came together and thought about why should something like Lumos Capital Group exist? What do we contribute into this ecosystem as part of it? The impact piece of it is just a part of the DNA that we started with. It's important personally to each one of us. And so it was part of the ethos that we built in. We want to find meaning and purpose in our work through backing impactful companies, companies that are making a positive difference in the world, that are contributing to human flourishing over time. And that keeps us excited, enthusiastic about our work on a day-to-day basis. And the second reason is because we believe in what we've called collinearity, which is really just a fancy term for, as a company's impact, positive impact on its stakeholders grows over time, its financial success and business success should be directly correlated to that, certainly over the long term. When you think about this sector as a whole, why does anyone spend money ultimately on an educational product and service? You might try it out, but if it doesn't work, if it's not delivering the service that you as a consumer, as an end user, as a learner, or as a teacher are hoping for, eventually you'll churn off of it, you'll switch to something else. What we're looking for is something that has that powerful impact, that is delivering access perhaps that you as a learner didn't have before. And you engage in it in a certain way that enables you to have a much better outcome over time. You'll continue to spend money on it, or a public sector or a government or a school district will continue to spend money on it. I think about Duolingo as one example. We talked about it. Why do people continue to use it? It's fun and they're learning real things through it, and it's effective. And that combination of engagement and efficacy has created a positive cycle through which this company has continued to grow users over time. And so that collinearity ultimately contributes to our success as a fund, because if the companies that we invest in are delivering that impact, they'll end up being financially more successful over the long term, and that will accrue to the benefit of the fund and our investors. And so those are a couple of the reasons why we've invested so much time and energy thinking about it. I can also unpack a little bit more about the how of how we go about it.
Collinearity, that's another term for the day. So we've got missionaries, not mercenaries, and we've got collinearity, which are two of the phrases that I'll take with me from our conversation. What I like about the topic of collinearity is it's both. It's a focus on both the returns and the commercial side of it, as well as the impact, rather than solely focusing on one or the other and seeing that they grow together. So yeah, I'd love to dive deeper in then as you think about your process from, you know, identifying a company right through to it's become a portfolio company and you're serving on the board and eventually exiting. How do you think about impact at varying stages in the journey?
Well, we've developed a framework that really rests on three pillars. The first is quality outcomes. The second is access. And the third is equity. And by quality outcomes, we are thinking about, does this product ultimately create an impact that enables that learner, that user, to really move forward from a learning or teaching perspective? Does it create a better employment outcome? Does the learner progress in the way that it was intended when we designed that product and service? And ultimately, does it do so better than the status quo? And so when we think about transfer, and perhaps I'll use that same company as an example, because it hits across all three of these elements, we saw that you could actually learn faster and you could remember longer in the VR setting. You know, when I demoed the product myself in the early stages, getting to know the company, I did a little module in how to change oil in a car. And I think about the fact that today I still remember the basic steps on how to do it, because I actually used my hands and there was a little AI-driven digital coach in my ear telling me how I did it. When I did it wrong, I immediately was able to correct it. And because I used all my senses in doing it, and that level of emotional resonance, it was distraction-free. And then I could practice over and over again, just led to a better outcome. And transfer actually has also given learners the ability to figure out whether or not they like doing something. Sometimes the, you know, for example, some of transfer's customers, when they hire from a temp agency, let's say in an automotive industry context, they find that the churn of the employees that they hire is actually extraordinarily high. You know, the majority of employees after 3 months or 6 months actually are no longer there, you know, when they hire from a temp agency. But when they hire from people who have been trained on transfers simulations, those people may be three or four times more likely to be around 3, 6, or 9 months down the road, because they actually have felt what it's like to do the job. And so that level of exposure and experience actually means that the employer is saving costs in terms of onboarding and training and recruiting, and has a better outcome as well as the learner. And so those are things that we look for, because it is more likely that the company will be successful over time when it is delivering on that front. In terms of access, we think about who didn't have access or who doesn't have access today in the status quo to a particular type of learning outcome, and whether this product and service creates more access for that group of people. Because transfer is actually bought by the community college or the workforce development board, it's provided for free to the adult learner. And so if today you're unemployed, you walk into your local employment agency and you don a headset and you have a little bit of training, or you have access to career exploration that enables you to see a whole area of employment that you previously hadn't thought of, and you're able therefore to move onto a different type of career ladder that provides access to education and employment opportunity that you didn't have previously in a way that is cost-free to the individual. And so transfer really sort of hits the mark there in terms of access. And then in terms of equity, we think about how the existing system may have advantaged or disadvantaged certain groups of individuals through no fault of their own, and whether or not this company or product actually helps to redress them of those things. In the case of learning, for example, we know that everyone learns differently. Some people are just differently abled and might have troubles or struggles with traditional educational formats, as I mentioned. And so VR actually provides a different modality that enables many people who struggle with traditional educational formats. Perhaps they dropped out of college or high school because the traditional format just wasn't working for them, but they don the headset. It's a more akin to playing a video game, and suddenly they're able to learn in a different way. And so it provides a really interesting alternative way of acquiring skills that we were very excited about when we first came across the company. And so that framework is one we apply to every investment opportunity. We don't necessarily need to hit every single one in order to move forward with the investment, but we really are looking for companies that can move the ball forward in some of these areas. Now, we developed this framework in conjunction with our Impact Advisory Council, chaired by one of our LPs called Impact Engine, Priya Parrish and Ander, who sit on that Impact Advisory Council alongside of many of the other very supportive LPs. And they help us and advise us as we go through the process of investing with an impact lens to hold us accountable and to hopefully make us better every year.
That's wonderful. And it's a holistic framework, outcomes, access, and equity. And thanks for running us through that example as well of transfer VR. As you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that in my home, Nyaki, my wife, hates the fact that I'm notoriously bad at DIY. And so a lot of the practical stuff, I probably should see if there's some training on it, like plumbing and the like, that could take my skills at least from zero to one. And again, you can't learn that by writing something down. It's practical. You have to actually get out and do it with your hands.
Well, you can't be worse than me. I have consumed thousands of DIY YouTube videos in pursuit of little projects around the house, but inevitably I need to consume more than one to get it right.
Yeah, 100%. And if I take then, Victor, this sector, you've been here for a long time. You've seen a lot of different companies and worked with them in varying capacities as well as an advisor and as an investor. Over that time, you must have seen some landmines. You must have seen some people step on them and some explosions. So, If you were talking to someone who's either new to investing in the sector or even has been investing in the sector, what are some of the key risks that people should look out for when investing in the edtech sector?
The sector is complex, and therefore we think it does really benefit from industry focus and specialization, because the go-to-markets, the way products are created, the way they're distributed, and some of the standards that need to be met in different end markets can be quite demanding and difficult to navigate. One particular area that is always important to pay attention to is regulation. Education tends to be, in particular end markets such as K-12, quite regulated. In other areas such as workforce development, corporate learning, and lifelong learning, much less so. But if you're investing in more of the traditional end markets, it is an area that you have to pay quite close attention to. We've seen the impact of that on companies across the board in various ways. Years ago, I was helping with a business in the Middle East that operated private schools. And all of a sudden, the Crown Prince of Dubai and the central governing authorities decided to freeze tuition across the entire region for a variety of reasons, but ultimately was just an area of regulation that created a huge amount of disruption. I've seen that kind of thing happen if you're not cautious or thoughtful and haven't paid attention to the policy and regulation side of things. You can get caught quite flat-footed. We've seen that happen in China and various other areas around the world. And so that's one area to pay close attention to. Another, I would say, is around data privacy, because education businesses also handle quite a bit of sensitive student data, similar to large consumer technology companies. And it's just important to handle that data very carefully in order to keep kids and students safe. And companies need to invest in the proper safeguards and infrastructure to do that. But I've also seen companies get into trouble when they've underinvested in that particular area.
That's great. So both the regulation, the data privacy side, I think one you mentioned briefly, but maybe I'll just expand on a little bit is the distribution side of this, where I'd say probably the most common pitfall that I see, I get contacted every now and again by talented young entrepreneurs looking for some sort of angel investment or early stage advice. And I think one of the most common pitfalls that I see there is a great product from built by a smart team, but selling into be it a school district or pretty much anywhere in education outside of the consumer tends to be quite slow and long. And because there's a premium on trust in this industry, this is education, and these are in many instances our children or ourselves and our own human capital, we generally have a higher bar to something that's new. So I've seen that just multiple times now in the very early stages. That's obviously different to where you invest. By the time they're getting to you in the growth stage phase, very different from angel, they've already got multiple millions of dollars of revenue and client base, and to some extent have distribution. But I would want to flag that just this industry does take time, and it's not about having the shiny product. It's about having the shiny product and distribution.
absolutely right. The end markets can be quite fragmented. When you think about the U.S. market as one example, and if you were to take the K-12 end market, there are over 100,000 schools across our 50 states. There are something like 14 to 15,000 school districts. And so within each school district, there are multiple centers of budget and purchasing power. And depending on what you are selling, ultimately, you may ultimately need to go through multiple layers, perhaps at the state level and then at the district level and then ultimately at the school level. And so if you don't have that expertise and if you haven't thought about a go-to-market distribution plan, it can be very, very challenging to navigate all of the budgetary cycles and all of the people involved with such a fragmented end user and end market base.
And the final question then on Lumos and on EdTech, before I come back to you specifically, Victor, is more on the upside. If you're looking forward, what are you excited about? What is Lumos excited about? Are there any particular verticals or any areas broadly within EdTech that you're excited about at the moment?
We haven't really talked about AI. It's very hard to have a conversation these days with my LPs or prospective investors or even folks in the market generally without talking about this subject. It is an area that we are both excited by and also, you know, we think about in terms of some of the challenges that it does pose in the sector and for society as a whole. I'll touch on both sides of the coin for a moment. You know, technology is moving so fast. You know, we think about what's happened over the last 3 years with AI and the new generations of AI platforms that have come out. Clearly, there is a race going on, obviously within the technology companies themselves, but more broadly, there's a race between technology and education. You know, if technology runs too far in front of education and society's ability to educate its people to meet the needs of what that technology is presenting or demanding or requiring, then more inequality will arise and people will have less economic opportunity. And you've seen that in the economic cycles in the past, going back many generations. And we're in one of those cycles right now where I feel like technology is running way ahead and we need to invest in people, in reskilling, to be able to bring people up to meet the challenges of their times. And every company today is thinking about how to utilize technology to increase efficiency. And it's commonly stated now that, you know, an individual, not that you will be replaced by AI, but you will be replaced by someone who knows how to use AI. But I think it's also true that so many jobs and functions today are going to be impacted in transformative ways. And certainly a lot of roles are going to disappear. Of course, many new ones will arise as well. And so the need to invest in people has never been more urgent, both from the public sector and the private sector perspective, because when you have that dislocation and people don't have the skills to ultimately be able to meet the economic opportunity around them, then a lot of suffering ends up happening, a lot of societal dislocation, et cetera. And so that's both the challenge and the opportunity, because I think about the companies today that are trying to tackle that problem in terms of reskilling and upskilling individuals. It's incredibly urgent, and both the public and private sectors need to invest behind it. Now, the flip side of the coin is that AI is presenting all sorts of opportunities to enhance learning in terms of personalization. You know, the holy grail that many companies are chasing is a truly personalized AI tutor. You know, you've thought about, and something we can certainly, you know, go into at some point is around Benjamin Bloom's sort of two sigma problem, which where he talks about how ultimately the most impactful education is personalized one-on-one tutoring. But that always has been impossible to scale because of the human labor that is required to be able to deliver that well. You know, today AI is starting to get to the place where you can actually, everyone can have an AI tutor in their pocket. And you think about the impact of that over time in terms of being able to catch people up who are behind or help people really pursue certain areas that they otherwise weren't able to because of the skills acquisition that they can have through an AI tutor. It's really amazing to think about. And so that's just an area of opportunity that I'm really excited to continue to explore and potentially invest behind.
That's really interesting. And yes, AI is absolutely the topic of our time. One of the ways of gauging the zeitgeist that I normally do is, I serve on a few corporate boards. So it's seeing what does everyone want board training about and what's the board training of the time? So if I go back to sort of 2020, 2021, a lot of it was around sustainability. Then came the cybersecurity trend. So probably most of the last 2 years, we've spent a lot of time learning about cybersecurity and a lot of that kind of training. And then again, this year, I've very much seen the shift towards AI. And that's over the last year and a half. And that's very much the cycle that we're in. But this is, as you say, a monumental shift up there with some of, the big shifts like the industrial revolution and the like, and will play out over many, many decades. And the opportunity to invest behind it through education technology is a very interesting and attractive path in the long term. So let me come back then to you as an individual, Victor. We've spoken about growth stage investing in EdTech. We've spoken about Lumos, and I've thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. And as I come back to you, I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests. And that is, please tell us about your favorite teacher or lecturer or educator.
I've had so many over time. It's hard to name just one, but a person who stands out right away would be Ms. Christine Huang back in high school. So when I went back to Taiwan for high school, because of the curriculum that I had followed in other countries prior, I actually was a year behind in math. And I went to this small public school called the National Experimental High School. It had some experimental curriculum and then we were all guinea pigs, I suppose. But I had a small class and everyone else was a year ahead of me in math just based on the curriculum that they were following. So I had to sit in the year behind and it was not fun for me, as you can imagine. Well, Christine Huang, Ms. Huang was actually the dean of that school at the time. And she saw what was going on right away. And she actually found time in her schedule to privately tutor me to catch me up on the year of math that I otherwise should have already finished at that point in time. And because of Benjamin Bloom's two sigma problem in a one-on-one tutoring context, actually only took about 3 months, but she was able to get through a whole year's worth of curriculum. But I think about the fact that ultimately enabled me to get to the AP level and be able to, get through high school a certain way and get to college a certain way. And it was because of her personal investment. She didn't have to do it. She just noticed something, saw a particular issue, saw that I was not where I should have been and stepped in. And I think about the impact of a caring adult, a caring teacher. It really cannot be overstated. So I actually had the opportunity a few years ago when I was back in Taiwan to go down to my school in Hsinchu. It's a small city, hour and a half south of Taipei, to see her. It was the year she was retiring. And so I had an opportunity to see her and express my gratitude and appreciation for everything she'd done. Because I think back on my journey, my work journey over the last 30 to 40 years, and so much of it is due to that type of investment, particularly her investment. And so I really want to thank her.
That's a wonderful story to close us off on, Victor. And thank you for sharing. And it's great to me because it comes back full circle to what is important here. We've spoken about growth stage investing. We've broken it down in the context of EdTech, but ultimately it's all about the outcomes for the individuals, for the students, for the individuals, for the teachers, and all of that enables it. And that is a wonderful story to bring it back and ground the conversation in what's important. Thank you so much today. You've really given a masterclass today on growth stage investing in EdTech, and I've really enjoyed the conversation with you. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.